Jive Talkin' is the subject. Dr. Adam Blood, he is the director of speech and debate in the communications department at the University of West Florida. I have him on for a very particular reason. Dr. Blood, welcome to the Pensacola Morning News, sir.
Thank you for having me. How are you doing?
Oh, man, I'm doing great. I have been so looking forward to this interview. Here's for folks who do not know, the reason I wanted to have this interview, I don't remember what made me think of it, but I was thinking of the kinds of little verbal tics that are so common in speech that serve no function, really. The one that drives me crazy when I hear other people do it, and yet I have adopted it because my speech mannerisms are very malleable. I will pick things up pretty easily, even against my will. So, what do you think? The so to introduce a sentence. Or, you know, it's like this. The you know in a transitional phrase. I use those. I don't mind the you know. I mind the so. Well, all of these things. I just wanted to talk to a professional about this. First of all, do these speech tics or extraneous elements of speech, do they serve a function?
They absolutely do. One of the purposes they serve is that we think at about 800 words per minute, and the estimates tend to vary, but we speak at about 125. So a lot of the times these are, like you said, they're just sort of empty verbal fillers. But there are some times where they can actually serve a purpose. In some cases, they change the rhythm of a sentence to where a sentence just sounds better coming out of a person's mouth, like a long, you know, before somebody goes into what they're going to say. And other times, they can actually create some sort of padding for a sentence. So here's an example. Let's say you ask a coworker to lunch, and you say, hey, do you want to go to lunch with me? And they say, well, you know, I'm kind of busy Of course, it's a lot of words that aren't actually saying anything, but it pads the sentence a little bit, or it pads the reaction a little bit, where it takes away some of the abrasiveness and curtness, as opposed to, hey, do you want to go to lunch? No, right? That that has the effect of padding a sentence. But for a lot of people, it's just the inability to pause in the middle of a sentence, and they use words to sort of fill that silence, because people kind of believe that if they're not speaking, people are going to second guess them, or it looks like they don't know what they're about to say. And so it's really how we handle what we're communicating while we're communicating.
Yeah, so there. Okay, both of those right there. Yeah, and so to me, they are a way of facilitating relational communication. They are definitely carrying communicative value, even though they don't serve a grammatical purpose. And in that sense, I think you can justify them. I mean, if people don't like that, I use right there, that's a way I speak. People are used to hearing me speak this way. If I get rid of it, it may sound a little different or more abrasive or less something. And that's basically what you're saying, right?
Absolutely. And sometimes those verbal fillers, you're using them to communicate something in particular. So I could think of kind of two examples of this. When I first started teaching, it meant a lot to me that I would stop in the middle of lecture or in the middle of a lesson and make sure people were understanding me. And the way I would do that is I would say the word right, R-I-G-H-T. So it'd be communication is a human process, right? Words change as we understand them, right? And that became my verbal filler. Right was to me what like and so was to everybody else. And I didn't realize how repetitive it was getting until I had a student who started counting them on the first day of class. And at the last day of class, right before I gave the exam, this student who had never really spoken up in class much before raised her hand and said, you've said the word right, and then gave me a preposterous number. It had to have been something like 1,200 times. Oh, and I didn't realize it until I realized somebody was counting it. And the worst thing about that is once you start becoming self-conscious about your verbal fillers, they happen more.
Oh, it's the worst. And so, you try to fix it. That invitation, to me, as a former teacher, I would ask people, do y'all understand? Or is there anybody who doesn't understand because you want to invite the negative because that's the only way somebody speaks up? I would do that all the time. And when you're saying right, it's an invitation. It sets a tone. It creates the expectation. Even if it's dumb, you do it 1,200 times, there's something conveyed in that about your willingness to have people question, challenge, or just ask questions of ignorance. But you said there were two examples. There's another, yet another example of how it functions for us?
Yeah. So if you think about political speech, if you think about politicians in press conferences or talking to the media, this use of verbal fillers can really humanize them. Because if you create the impression that you're trying to find the correct word or you're trying to really consider what you're about to say, this gets away from the assumption that a lot of these politicians, everything they say is a well-rehearsed, focused group soundbite. So if they're too eloquent, they can come across as somewhat robotic. But if they're measured and if they're having a lot of these ums, it can really create the impression that they are humanized, that struggling with language is something that normal people go through. And so some of these prolific figures, some of these orators who are in front of people, the occasional like, so, or you know, can have the effect of humanizing them.
I'm thinking of Obama. He clearly did this deliberately. His speech pauses, patterns, uhs and ums, and slowness, it was not the way he would speak when he was talking off the cuff or excited about something. His speech giving was very different. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Absolutely. So we know that Barack Obama, because we've seen him in speeches, and even his biggest detractors would admit that the man knew how to put a sentence together. He was very good oratorically speaking. So if he's doing an interview, if he's talking to somebody in the press and he wants to convey this idea that he is someone who thinks before he speaks, he'd put a pause in what he was saying. And I'm not saying like every time he made the decision, it was a deliberate, I'm going to say here, but he had to have assumed at some point that if you put a pause in the middle of a sentence, the people listening will think that you're Boston. And so that gave this impression.
Your Obama's pretty good, by the way. That, Go ahead.
Oh, I throw it in class so that my students don't get bored, or if they're not paying attention, it really confuses them. So that was his way of sort of humanizing himself.
So weirdly, in a situation where if you're too eloquent, people might hold it against you, which I have seen that happen both with vocabulary and style of speech. People hold against you if you seem too well-spoken. Sometimes you do it as a deliberate way of humanizing. You do it as a deliberate way of making yourself look a little worse so that people can relate. Oh, my goodness. This is everything I was hoping this interview would be. Dr. Adam Blood, we're talking. He's a director of speech and communications. The director of speech and debate in the communications department at UWF. So somebody actually texted me right at the beginning of the segment when I was introducing you and said, Andrew, you're being very articulate and methodical right now in the way you're speaking. True, because I was self-conscious about my own verbal tics, and here I am in front of the expert speaking a way that we're going to exactly talk about. So I guess my next question is, do they interfere? Should they be things we try to fix? Because we know trying to fix them is very, very hard. Should they be things we try to fix? And if we should, how do we fix them?
It might become an issue if the verbal fillers, if the us, ums, likes, if they become really distracting, mm-hmm, in terms of our ordinary everyday conversation, or if we're speaking to the public, if it really becomes something that we feel is distracting. For me, I recognized when I was speaking in front of people, the rights were becoming an issue. It's really one of those things of what are you trying to accomplish with your language? If the us, ums, and likes are affecting your ability to function when you're communicating with somebody, then maybe you take some steps to try to correct it. The worst thing you could try to do is just say, I'm going to never try to say right, so, or you know, because the more you try to avoid it, the more you worry about it. And since a lot of these verbal fillers come because our brain is working faster than our mouth, if you add that on, you're just adding more things for your brain to be doing while your mouth is moving. So the way I've always tried to coach people away from verbal fillers and things like competitive speaking, speech and debate, when the us, ums, likes can be the difference between winning and losing if you're trying to really perform well, is I always coach people to focus very specifically on the content of what they're saying. If you really focus on just one thing, you'll notice that a person their verbal fillers go away a little bit more, the more they're focusing on just that moment in their speech. If you focus on that, it takes a lot of the mental load off, and you'll notice very slowly but surely that it starts to dwindle away at the number of verbal fillers that you have.
Interesting. Well, the old rule is you can't, you know, nature hates a vacuum, which is, you know, a physics analogy for speech is a little bit of a stretch. But the point being, when you try to not do a thing, your brain doesn't work very well at that. If you try to actively do a replacement thing, your brain works a lot better at that. And so finding a way to focus on the words, and then you will naturally fill them in the right manner. Interesting. The other one, we didn't really get to talk about this either, but the pause, the value of space. I'm not that good at this. I know I'm not. I tend to fill my spaces with uhs and ums when just leaving it blank would probably be more effective. But what a fascinating conversation. My takeaway, you tell me if I've got this wrong, my takeaway is that generally speaking, what we think of as these verbal tics often have a purpose, function for communication, and are not the flaws that our grammar instructor might otherwise think they are, but they can become a distraction or an impediment. And if they get that way, then you probably ought to work on managing them. Is that a fair summary?
Absolutely, absolutely. And for a lot of people, it's just a matter of getting comfortable speaking in front of people.
Oh, yeah.
Public speaking is a lot of people's biggest fear. So things like verbal fillers will become the sort of issue that they deal with while they're doing it. And then adding on to this complication is that pause that you're talking about. A lot of people get really uncomfortable if they're speaking in front of a group of people. They think if there's a second of silence, everything is just going to fall apart.
Oh, yeah.
But you're right. There is a point where this can serve a purpose, uhs, ums, and likes. If used sparingly and thoughtfully, they can communicate something, and they can become an issue, but it's not an insurmountable issue. It can be overcome.
Well, very interesting conversation. I know I'm going to mess this up, and now people are attuned to it, so they will pick up all of them that I make. It's going to be extra fun for a day or two. Dr. Adam Blood, the Director of Speech and Debate at the UWF Communications Department. Adam, thanks so much for the time. Very interesting conversation. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed talking to you.